This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. How are you today, Greater Boston? Because it is a heck of a Monday. The biggest election of most, if not all, of our lifetimes is winding down, we think. The biggest pandemic in 100 years is raging back for a second wave. And the world's oldest continuous democracy feels like it might be in the balance. We're going to bring it all to you this week as it unfolds and talk with you about it. And a lot unfolded just today. In three separate press conferences, Governor Charlie Baker announced new executive orders to curb the coronavirus. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh addressed record voter turnout, and Secretary of the Commonwealth Bill Galvin called Donald Trump's behavior illegal.
What we should not do to deal with these trends is shut down our economy or close our schools.
If you're not happy with the direction of this country, go out and vote. If you're happy with the direction of this country, go out and vote. That's what the message should be today.
As one of the nation's senior election administrators, I find the president's comments both appalling, disturbing, and really criminal.
So WBUR reporters Steve Brown and Kyrie Thompson were at all the press conferences today. They join us now, Steve and Kyrie. Happy Monday to you.
Same to you, Tiziana.
Kyrie, do we have you too? Okay, well, Steve, I'm going to start with you because we're going to turn to you first. It's all right. I'm going to start with Steve anyway, Kyrie, because I want to get through these announcements. Governor Baker had a press conference at about 1:30, and he made some pretty big announcements. Let's start there, Steve. Tell us what's new.
Well, everyone, as of Friday, will be required to wear a face covering. It doesn't matter how far you can be from others. If you're out in public, wear a mask. He's going to roll back some of the openings, more of a curfew type thing. Indoor recreation venues such as theaters, casinos, and other entertainment-based businesses have to close by 9:30 at night. Restaurants will have to stop table service at 9:30, but they could continue with takeout service. Liquor sales must also end by 9:30. They're rolling back the private gatherings must be limited to 10 or few people for indoor events, 25 or fewer people at outdoor gatherings. All gatherings inside and outside also have to be over by 9:30 p.m. They're trying to eliminate some of these house parties that we've been hearing about. Here's the governor talking about what he hopes the overall effect of these new executive orders will be.
The most effective weapon against this virus, of course, remains personal responsibility. With these measures, it's our hope that we can encourage everyone to act responsibly and stay away from riskier activities, group social activities, social interactions with people you're just too familiar with.
Now, the governor says that we should not be shutting down the economy or closing schools to halt the spread. But he adds that if we do nothing, we will create problems for the healthcare community as they try to deal with this virus as the fall goes on.
So let me clarify two things, Steve. One, is there a curfew? And two, is this mask usage anytime you're out in public, is that a mandate?
It's a good way of framing it, that it is a curfew. They want people to avoid situations where people would gather, and they're hopeful that by pulling the plug on things at 9:30 at night, things might not get out of hand. As for the mask mandate, it's a bit more clarified. Before, there were exceptions, and the key provision of the old mask advisory was where you were to wear a mask if you could not safely social distance. Now you're supposed to be 6 feet apart, 8 feet apart, that, you know, nobody's out there measuring or anything like that. Now it's a blanket order. If you're outside of your home or office, wear a mask.
All right. So you mentioned that the governor's saying, I don't want to shut down schools, I don't want to shut down businesses. There will be economic impact here. Did he talk about that at all for businesses, for essential workers?
Essential workers still will be going to work. There's an exception for that curfew for people that are working overnight. So they're not going there. They're just, again, kind of trimming for restaurants and casinos and venues like that. 9:30, that's the cutoff time for that.
And did he say anything about the election tomorrow, Steve? It's got to be on his mind.
Yeah, he said get out and vote, which is probably a good thing if you haven't done so already. A lot of people already have. He did talk a little bit about post-election this week. I know a lot of people are concerned. What's going to happen after the election is over? When we assume somebody's going to be declared the winner, will there be some sort of a backlash here in the Boston area or Massachusetts after the election's over? The governor has activated 1,000 members of the National Guard, more so to be on standby in the aftermath of the election. He says that several communities have asked for this more as a precaution than anything else.
Okay, thanks for that, Steve. So there were these other two press conferences today that both focused on the election. Kyrie, I'm going to bring you back in here because one of those was with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. You were there. What did he want to tell people today?
Well, I'd say the mayor's comments boil down to two essential points, really. Get out and vote, for one, but more importantly, do it safely. And, it wasn't just talking about safety during the pandemic, which is something that, we're going to talk about. But he spent a lot of time talking about the tension surrounding the election. He said it's unlike anything he's ever seen before, and that no matter what the outcome is, that he expects emotions to run high, regardless of who wins. And he says that's okay. It's okay to have that emotion, but he urged restraint and respect, both at the polls and after the voting is done. And if you want to speak out about the results, do so peacefully. He also took a moment to address concerns about the results maybe not being known tomorrow night and us perhaps not knowing the full picture of the election until later in the week. He said that, it's fairly normal for us not to know exactly, to not have all the votes counted on Tuesday night or even Wednesday night, but sometimes we don't know for a little while, and that mail-in ballots are not necessarily, they're not a problem, right? They're just, you treat them just like, absentee ballots for the military or, people who can't get to the polls. So it's notable that he didn't mention President Trump's name here, but I took that to kind of a veiled response to President Trump's preparations to cast aspersions on anything that, the election results not being known by tomorrow night.
So Kyrie,
basically saying this is a process.
So just very briefly, did he talk about turnout and what he's expecting?
Yes. So he mentioned that it looks like this election season could break some records. Over 432,000 Bostonians have already registered to vote, about 15,000 more than 4 years ago, and that more than 150,000 ballots have already been cast, about 55,000 through early ballots and more than 100,000 through mail-in. So he said that that's more than, 33, almost 34% of the registered number of voters that have already voted, and noted that only 66%, or just about, total voted in 2016. So he thinks that they're going to exceed, if not shatter, that tomorrow.
So Steve, you were at Secretary Galvin's press conference. Let's build on what Kyrie was just saying. What is he saying about what turnout's been so far and what he's expecting?
Yeah, we're headed toward a record turnout when all is said and done. We're looking at about 75% turnout. Secretary Galvin says that 2.3 million people in Massachusetts have voted already, either by mail or through early voting. And he says that about 1.3 million will actually turn out in person tomorrow.
And what about the breakdown between suburban and urban voters? My understanding is he's been watching that.
Yeah, he says that he expects a big turnout tomorrow in the urban areas, in the cities. He says that's always been the case, and that's what he's expecting tomorrow.
So, Kyrie, that ties into the kind of turnout that Mayor Walsh is expecting on Election Day. Tell us what he's talking about physical safety. We just heard about the new steps that Governor Baker's taking because the coronavirus is surging.
Right. And, he started off his presser by acknowledging the coronavirus numbers from Massachusetts and in Boston specifically. He mentioned that there were 112 new cases from over the weekend. And so he's acknowledging the rising cases. He said that there are going to be clear social distancing measures and markers at the polling locations, and that the polling locations will be cleaned multiple times throughout the day himself to keep things disinfected as much as possible. And as he's often said in the past, he's telling everyone who goes out to vote in person tomorrow to wear a mask. So here's what he had to say more generally about what he wants people to do.
Don't try and make a political statement tomorrow by going to vote without a mask. Have the courtesy for the people around you, the people in line. Some locations might have long lines. We're asking you to be patient as you move forward.
So as you can see, not really up for debating the whole mask point. So he really expects people to do that, but also to really think about the people that are there and think about the polling workers. He said that these are very experienced people. They've done this before, but this is a different kind of situation.
And Steve Brown, in this last little bit, Secretary Galvin surprised me a little, got kind of fiery about the president and his increased attacks on the ballots, not cast on Election Day, on count of ballots, et cetera. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, he is miffed at the comments from the president questioning the security of mail-in voting, although it's important to point out that Galvin, a Democrat, has often been quick to call out the Republican administration on a lot of things. He says that for years, Massachusetts has been allowing some form of vote by mail, and that it has gone off without a hitch. He expects the same this week as well for those who have voted by mail. Galvin says the president's statements about mail-in ballots are simply untrue.
Here in Massachusetts, it has been our practice for many, many years that members of the military, if they voted and had their ballot postmarked by the date of the election, their ballot will be counted, even if it was received up to 10 days later. To suggest that somehow this is criminal or this is improper or this is illegal is disgraceful and criminal.
Now, Galvin says it's important that every citizen who participates in the election properly has their ballot properly executed before the close of the election, before Election Day, and make sure that it is received in the best way that they can, that their vote is counted. He says that it's extremely important for the integrity of the electoral process and the future of our democracy.
Well, I know you'll both be at the polls tomorrow, and we'll look forward to following you. That's WBUR's Steve Brown and Kyrie Thompson. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It is finally here, Election Week, and we will be bringing you local perspective, the latest on the results each day. Today, that means checking in on New England races in New Hampshire, Maine, Massachusetts, and all this week we'll bring you analysis and conversation about tomorrow's historic election. I want to start with New Hampshire. We have WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks with us. Hey there, Anthony.
Hi, Tiziana.
So tell us a little about New Hampshire's first congressional district. I know it's unfolding, or it has unfolded pretty interestingly. It's flipped, I think, every time in the last five election cycles. Tell us about that.
Yeah, more or less. I mean, so this covers the eastern end of the state, and it seems like this is a district that really can't make up its mind whether to send a Republican or a Democrat to Washington. So between 2008 and 2016, that's five election cycles in a row. It rocked back and forth. It elected a Democrat to Congress and a Republican, then a Democrat, then a Republican, and then a Democrat. And it's been described, to me by one veteran lawmaker up in New Hampshire as the swingiest district in the country. And we should say the incumbent is Democrat Chris Pappas. He was elected 2 years ago, and he's trying to become the first incumbent in 12 years to win back-to-back races in this district. And he's running against Matt Maurer, who worked in the Trump State Department, backed by President Trump. And the race really boils down to Maurer argues that Pappas is sort of, you know, wedded to Nancy Pelosi, and that's bad. And Pappas has worked very hard to link Maurer to President Trump. And that may be working for him because Trump isn't polling very well in New Hampshire. He's running 8 or 9, 10 points behind, depending on which poll you're looking at. So it's not a good moment, at least in New Hampshire, to be linked to President Trump right now.
Speaking of the moment in New Hampshire, briefly, what's early voting like there? How much of this is going to come down to tomorrow?
Well, a lot's going to come down. New Hampshire doesn't have early voting. They do have absentee ballots, but there's no in-person early voting. But absentee ballots are way up. I think the last number I saw last week was something like a quarter of all folks have voted through absentee ballots, and that's way up over 2016. but most people will be voting on Election Day tomorrow in New Hampshire.
All right, so that's New Hampshire. Anthony, please sit tight. I'm going to turn to Maine for a few minutes here, because up in Maine, the fate of the entire U.S. Senate could hang in the balance. Democratic Speaker of the House, Maine House, Sarah Gideon, is looking to unseat Republican Senator Susan Collins, the longest-serving woman in the Senate. It has been a pitched battle, slews of money. We've got Maine Public Radio's chief political correspondent Steve Missler here catching us up. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks for having me.
So how did this race get this big, Steve, in terms of money, importance, national attention?
Yeah, well, you just touched on it. I mean, the first reason is that it's one of a handful of seats that could determine control of the U.S. Senate next year. But to even get to that point where a race against Susan Collins is even competitive, you have to have a lot of other factors sort of line up to create a bit of a perfect storm, and we definitely have those. The president is unpopular in Maine statewide. So that right away is a drag on Collins because they belong to the same party. But Collins has always outperformed the top of the ticket, including in 2008, which was a huge wave year for Democrats. Collins weathered that with her moderate reputation. What's different this time, though, is President Donald Trump. He's such a polarizing figure that many voters here see the Senate race as a binary choice. You either oppose this president or you support him. And Collins has taken several votes that have called into question whether she's as independent as she's long claimed to be. And there are voters here who really see some of those votes as a betrayal. That's why Democrat Sarah Gideon is hammering home the argument that Collins has changed. She's not who she once was.
And how big is the Brett Kavanaugh vote, her vote in, to support him for the Supreme Court in all of this?
Yeah, that's huge. I mean, you can literally draw a straight line from the Kavanaugh vote to Collins's decline in popularity. I mean, she used to be one of the most popular members of the U.S. Senate, and now she's one of the least popular. And, you know, you could argue that the decline began with her vote for the Republican tax overhaul in 2017, but it was really Kavanaugh that initiated the big slide in favorability, especially among women. And women have long been part of Collins's winning coalition, stretching all the way back to when she was first elected to the Senate in 1996. She also has identified as a pro-choice Republican. But when she voted for Kavanaugh, who was nominated precisely because the president was trying to please his pro-life constituency, a lot of women viewed that as a betrayal here. And it also initiated a massive fundraising operation that drew some $4 million that was directly transferred straight to Sarah Gideon's campaign when she became the Democratic nominee over the summer. And since then, activists and liberal interest groups have spent millions keeping up the pressure. Even before the campaign, there were ads and events designed to keep the Kavanaugh vote top of mind. And I think that's a big part of the reason why Collins has remained in trouble.
All right, so let's dig into the cases the two candidates are making. Let's start with Democrat Sarah Gideon. We haven't talked about her yet. What's her case?
Yeah, so Gideon was a relatively unknown political figure here before the race began. I mean, she's currently the Speaker of the Maine House, but that's not really a position that a ton of people follow that closely. And in some ways, that may have benefited her because her campaign has been able to fill in the blanks, if you will, and position her as a moderate who voters trust to potentially replace Collins, not some hardcore partisan, which I think, generally speaking, Maine voters tend to reject. But her primary argument is that Collins has done the bidding of President Trump. And it's an argument she made a week ago when the president showed up here to campaign on short notice. Here's what she said.
Senator Collins may not want to be seen here today, but make no mistake, over the past 4 years, she has chosen over and over again to stand up for Donald Trump and his priorities ahead of Mainers.
So you can hear there that Gideon made note that Collins did not show up for Trump's visit. And that's part of her campaign, her argument, really, that Collins is hiding her support for the president and not being forthcoming with Maine voters.
So what's Collins's argument?
Well, Collins is making the classic incumbent argument, which is that there's no reason for voters to gamble on Gideon. She's too risky. And Collins has basically been saying, look, you know me, and even if you don't like the way I vote some of the time, you know that I'm trying to do what's right, what's in, you know, what I think is a principled decision. The other case she's trying to make is that she's high in seniority in the Senate and could become chair of the powerful Appropriations Committee. But her primary argument is that she's delivered for Maine and that Gideon won't be a suitable replacement. And here's what she said when I interviewed her in early October about that.
Nor would she have the clout and seniority that I have to bring much needed assistance into our state.
Yeah, the other thing to note here is that Collins is really trying to denationalize the race, you know, to move it away from Trump, which is, you know, problematic for her. And it's probably a smart strategy, but it's not quite clear whether it's a winning one. We just don't know that yet. I mean, she's been haunted by 2016, which is when she declared that Trump was unfit for the presidency. Now she won't say whether she's voting for him or not, and that's only served to bring more attention to the issue. And Democrats here have been needling at that for months, if not longer.
So the other thing I want to ask you, it's relevant to Massachusetts because ranked choice voting is on the ballot. I understand this is a close race. Is it possible that this Senate race could be decided using ranked choice voting?
Absolutely. Yeah, the way the polls are going right now, it's hard to see either of the two candidates breaking getting a clear majority on election night, which, of course, is the only way you can win outright in ranked choice voting when there's more than two candidates. And we do have two independents on the ballot here. So if neither Gideon nor Collins can break that 50+1 on Tuesday, then we could head to a ranked choice election, which could take some time. It could take a week potentially to settle the contest.
Is there a conventional wisdom on who is favored in a ranked choice voting scenario?
Yes, there's definitely a conventional wisdom, and it's that Gideon would benefit, and in part because there's an independent in the race, Lisa Savage, who is to the left of Gideon. So, you know, the conventional wisdom is that, you know, hardcore progressive voters are going to, you know, probably vote for Lisa Savage first, and then they'll rank Gideon second, in which case, if that actually comes to fruition, you know, Lisa Savage's second place votes could potentially put Gideon over the top. I don't know if it's that clear cut or not. We haven't seen enough polling that actually polls a ranked choice election here to suggest whether that conventional wisdom will actually hold true. There's a lot of surprises that we just can't foresee, but that's certainly where people think the race is going.
Well, I think that's going to be fascinating for us to watch from here. Steve Missler, Maine Public Radio's chief political correspondent. We'll say goodbye to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's turn back to WBUR's Anthony Brooks. Anthony, let's talk about the presidential election now, and now let's talk about Massachusetts. We've done New Hampshire. We've done Maine. Donald Trump got more than 1 million votes in the Commonwealth in 2016. What counties are you watching this time, and, you know, what are you expecting to see unfold?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, we think of Massachusetts as a very blue state, and of course it is. But as you said, 1 million folks in the state voted for Trump 4 years ago. Those were some communities along the South Coast. And then there's this interesting line of towns where we did a bunch of reporting basically from the New Hampshire border right down to the Connecticut border, running right down the middle of central Massachusetts. And these tend to be old mill towns. In a lot of ways, they sort of reflect the kind of dynamic that you saw in the upper industrial Midwest and those kinds of communities that supported Donald Trump. A lot of the same issues, manufacturing jobs gone. People feel kind of disconnected from the booming economy within the 128 area. So they voted for Donald Trump. So, yeah, we spent some time out there, did some reporting on that, tried to understand what it was that motivated voters, and went back recently to try to figure out, you know, to what extent people have shifted, have their views shifted 4 years into Donald Trump. And those are some of the communities that I'm going to be watching with interest. Assuming Biden does well tomorrow, it will be interesting to see if these communities move with him or not. Or
so you
if
went to-
Donald Trump is reelected, it'll be interesting to see if these communities remain with the president.
Yeah, I think one thing we can all agree on is it's going to be interesting. You went to Ware last week. Tell us what drew you to Ware and compare and contrast it to 2016.
Well, Ware is one of these towns, you know, right smack in the middle of the state. It's an old mill town, sort of down on its luck, about 10,000 people. Used to have sort of this booming economy around the mills that were there. And it voted for Trump in 2016. So I was interested in just going out and talking to people the other day. And we were also doing a feature on early voting and the high numbers. And so if I'm recalling correctly, 6,900 registered voters in Maine, 4,000, I'm sorry, in Ware, 4,000 of them had already voted by the end of last week. So that gives you a sense. And it kind of reflects what's going on all across the country. And I spoke to Patty Bono. She voted for Joe Biden because she told me that Trump has failed on several important issues.
I would say his handling of the virus, for one thing, climate, especially science, because global warming is a thing, and it worries me that he doesn't care about it. But I also don't like him. As a woman, I don't like him.
Now, her husband agrees that President Trump has mismanaged the health crisis, but he gives him credit for a strong economy before the pandemic. So Peter Bono voted for Trump and sort of represented this stark disagreement with one family that within one family that reflects the disagreement in a divided nation. Here's Peter Bono.
Again, when it comes to the economy, I'm a small business owner, so it worked for me.
And Tiziana, I said, you know, how does that conversation work out at home around the kitchen table? And he said, yeah, we don't talk about it at home. it's not a conversation we choose to have.
All right, let's stay with Ware
for a minute. In the interest of marital, right, yeah.
That's right. And don't we just know that that's happening at kitchen tables all across New England, right? So yeah. President Trump, you heard in the, you know, the top of the show when we talked about Galvin's press conference today, President Trump has made a lot of comments about election security, about mail-in voting. In a piece that you did on your visit to Ware, resident Joseph Martel told you that he's concerned about the results of this election. Here he is.
With mail-in voting and all that, it's just out of whack the way it's going. It's going to be fraud. And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if when the election comes along, we have a civil war.
Yeah, so, that was a...
Yeah,
go ahead, Tiziana.
Go for it. No, jump
well,
in and react to
that.
That
was a really troubling thing to hear. But, you know, that idea is out there. And that voter, Joseph Martel, has obviously been sort of absorbing the messages coming from the president, who's working hard to undermine confidence in the voting system. We should, you know, hasten to point out that there have been very, very few cases that have been documented over the years of voter fraud. But this is a narrative that the president has put out. This is a Trump supporter who is clearly parroting some of the concerns that the president has. I'm really concerned when I hear people talking about civil war. I don't believe it's going to come to that. I think Americans are more level-headed than that. But obviously, we're all anxious about how this is going to play out in the coming days.
So obviously, we can't know, and I'm not going to put you on the spot to prognosticate about what's going to happen tomorrow night in terms of results. But given your experience, what's the sort of time frame that you expect before the United States is certain about who the president is?
Boy, it's a really difficult question, and it really depends which states it comes down to. You know, Florida has already been counting its absentee vote, its mail-in ballots, I mean. So we might know early in the evening the results in Florida, the same in Arizona. If those two states, for example, show a strong result for Joe Biden, we actually might know something early in the evening. But it's more likely that we're going to be waiting for states like Pennsylvania and Michigan, which will begin the process of counting an enormous number of mail-in ballots. And that could take days. And that's the message that people have to understand. This isn't going to be like a traditional presidential race where we're going to watch TV until 10 or 11 in the evening and know who the president is. We might, but it seems more likely that we will not. And for some people to suggest that who's ever ahead at the end of Election Day should be declared the winner, that's just completely out of whack and inconsistent with the way with elections, the way we count votes in this country.
As I said at the top of the hour, man, what a week. We are closing in on an election tomorrow that's arguably the biggest in our lifetimes. And we're going to walk you through it. And we also want to create opportunities for you to talk to us, talk to each other, and this week, with so much unknown about to unfold, talk to community members who can offer some particular wisdom. Let's start that now. We have two really wise community members with us. Wilnelia Rivera is a Democratic strategist, founder of Rivera Consulting. Wilnelia was the chief strategist for Representative Ayanna Pressley's successful 2018 congressional campaign. And David Gergen, who advised four U.S. presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. He's also the founding director of the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School, where he is a professor. Wilnelia, David, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tiziana. Thank you. Wilnelia, it's nice to meet you.
Same here, and thank you.
So we want you to join us. What do you want to ask David Gergen and Wilnelia Rivera? How are you feeling as we reach 0 hour? What's at stake for you? This is an important one. What do you think is at stake for you, for the country? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So David, Wilnelia, I have been asking guests this question a lot lately because I feel like we're trying to use an old Jaws reference, we're still trying to size the shark, you know, how big a deal this is. So I'm going to ask you both. David, I'll go to you first.
Sure.
What is at stake in this election?
Well, Tiziana, far more than we could have imagined 6 months ago, a year ago. I think it's not only who's going to be the president, that's obvious, but I think democracy itself is on the line, and who we are as a people is on the line. And we can go to many of our European friends and say the election of Donald Trump was an aberration. 4 years ago, nobody expected it. He himself didn't expect it, but it happened. It was a fluke election. So see it as aberrational. This election will show you that we're more normal. That argument will stand if Joe Biden wins. But if Donald Trump wins, that argument's out the window. People will say that was not just an aberration. This was an affirmation of who you are as a people, and that's going to rattle the world, and I think badly damage our reputation as a country. Much less than not to talk about the kind of issues that I'm sure we'll want to talk about here at home.
So, David, before I turn to Wilnelia, you said two things. You said, you know, democracy's on the line and who we are as a people. You just talked through who we are as a people. How is democracy on the line in this election?
Largely because we've had a president whose administration has undermined so many norms and run over so many of the normal barriers that we have, so much of what we have, and has delegitimized our law enforcement, delegitimized our intelligence agencies, trying to delegitimize the press, trying to delegitimize Democrats, frankly, in so many different ways. And I think it is... There are a growing number of Americans, especially viewers of Fox, who buy into all of this, and it's changed their attitudes toward who we are indeed. And I think that what we know is we've watched other countries, especially in Europe, but also in the Philippines and in Venezuela and other countries, is that during times of great stress, especially on class and race, that countries, democratic countries, often turn to strongmen. And that's what we did, in effect, I think. There was a lot of unhappiness at the end of as of 4 years ago, a lot of anger at the people being marginalized, a lot of working-class people, especially white working-class people without college degrees. You know, they were really ticked off about the way the country was working, and they turned to a strongman. And the history of strongmen is if you reelect them, they tend to do very authoritarian things, and I think you can already see signs of that. With this administration, they're going to double down, for example, on some of the harsh immigration penalties, rules and regulations we already have. They're going to double down against the climate and so on.
Mm-hmm. So we have Wilnelia Rivera and David Gergen, and you call us 1-800-423-8255. So Wilnelia, David's just laid out, kind of combed out, the stakes for who we are as a people, the stakes for what it means for us as a democracy. You sort of set the tone for insurgent campaigns in 2018 with your strategy with Ayanna Pressley. What do you see at stake in this election? And you know, what are you paying closest attention to?
Yeah. Well, first, what I will say is that what's made America in the international landscape what America is our long-term quest for equality and equity and what that means in this country over the course of generations. So part of restoring our standing internationally also is directly connected to what happens on the domestic front. Because ultimately, it was generations of ignoring the consequences of greed, injustice, and corruption that led us here. Although there are factors that we can all point to in the immediate years leading up to the Trump presidency, it's also part of a generational fight. And win or lose, you know, my take on what's at stake in this election tomorrow is that Democrats must become the party that wants to manage and lead the conversation on the deepest and darkest parts of our past and our present. We've avoided this conversation in many different ways throughout our history. We've made major progress, and there's no denying that part. But what's required is nothing less than America's rebirth. We've had a narrative in this country of who we are and who we're supposed to be, but unfortunately, it's excluded too many people. Only some folks have access to inalienable rights, while others have not. And let's also be clear about who that is, right? Who that is on the backs of Black Americans and other people of color, but most importantly, on the back of Black Americans. And part of that legacy is a legacy of white supremacy. And that's what's allowed for someone like Trump, not just to be elected, to be clear, that's not what I'm trying to say, but that it's allowed someone to emerge in the way that he has, who was completely taken out the stability of our governance and our democracy over the course of 3.5 years, perfectly taking the race and gender and culture wedges that we have across our country and pitting us against each other, when in fact America's heartland is wherever we are. And continuing to talk to us as if we only exist in some parts of the country versus other isn't a good service for Democrats. And, you know, what's at stake in this election and for Democrats in particular is that win or lose on Election Day and the day after, because it won't be counted on the day of most likely, that they center themselves on this rebirth and make the hard decisions that it will take to redistribute this power.
Let's go to the phones, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Ashley on the line from Salem. Ashley, share your thoughts with us.
Hi, I'm a school social worker. I work with middle school kids. And what's on the line are two very important things. One, the way that we speak to people. Right now we have, as our leader, someone who speaks disrespectfully and what I would consider bullying, antagonistic behaviors. And number two, what we have on the line is the lack of acknowledgement that systemic racism exists in our country. He has actually said that he doesn't want that taught in our educational system. And we need to learn from our mistakes as a country. And I'm very concerned that if he is reelected, that he is going to minimize the opportunities for us to acknowledge the mistakes we've made.
Ashley, thanks for that. I appreciate it. And I'm going to break those two up. David, I'm going to go to you first with this idea. Ashley talked about the way we speak with people, the bullying, the tone. That is a vision of leadership that is consistent with the strong man thing that you talked about at the beginning.
Yes.
What is the tone of a leader? Take it out of Joe Biden or Donald Trump for a minute and just the next leader, the one who gets inaugurated in January, what's the tone that leader, whoever it is, needs to set? Not whether they will, but what they should.
Yeah. Well, I've been coming back over history to try to think about things like this, and I rediscovered a famous letter that John Adams, President John Adams, our second president, on the night he first moved into the White House, and it was new White House, and Abigail was back in Massachusetts, and he wrote a letter to her from the White House that second night, and in it he put a prayer, and the last line of that prayer was, "May none but wise and honest men govern under this roof." Today, of course, he would include women in that. But that thought, that view of what our politics should have, a noble quality to it, that has been a guiding spirit to us for most of our history. That very line from that prayer has been carved into the mantelpiece in the White House of the state dining room. FDR put it up there. Jack Kennedy put it into marble. And what's so obvious now is we, for the 4 years, we've had this torrent of lies, misrepresentations, the bullying, the disrespect, as I think is right, especially toward people of color, especially toward women of color. You know, there's nothing they can do that he won't criticize. And I think it has given women of color, by the way, especially black women, I think it's given them great moral authority in our society, and that's a good thing. But the big thing to me, Tiziani, is can we follow up on that thought about wise and honest? And I believe the first responsibility of the next president, especially if it's Biden, is to begin restoring trust of the American people in the institution and the fairness of our system and the fact that we are going to respect people, we're going to talk to people in a different way. I don't think we can solve these other problems until we make progress on the issue of trust. Trust has just declined sharply over the last 30, 40 years. It didn't start with Trump, but he has certainly accelerated it. And I just last point, I don't want to talk on too long, because I think Vilnelia makes a very, very good point about race and race relations. And given what has happened in the last few months, the way Black Lives Matter has taken hold, that people now are looking for something more, I think it's really critical that we not let this moment pass without doing something, without making real advances on the racial front. And I hope that Biden will follow that path. I know that's where his heart is.
Will Nelia, let me turn to you there, because the second thing that Ashley talked about in her call was our lack of acknowledgement of systemic racism. And you talked at the top of this segment about the need for Democrats to manage a conversation. Mm-hmm. How does the Democratic Party, regardless of who wins this week or over these next several days, whenever we find out who the winner is, take the next step in that conversation and in a way that brings all Americans into dialogue?
Well, I think there's a couple different ways to do that, right? And I think the first way to do it is that Democrats need to come to embrace a different form of leadership. A part of that is tackling front and center the deficit in trust that we have as a country, but it's also the lack of institutional justice and equity that has come from structural policy. Right? For too long, Democrats have asked us, especially in the last 20 or 30 years, to wait our turn in one way or another when it comes to issues of racial equity. And the reality is that not just the last 2 years, but the last 20 years of social injustice movements, whether it's the student immigrant movement or the reproductive justice movement or the movement for Black Lives movement, everyone's been asking that it's no longer possible to have our dream deferred, that what we need to do is actually move the structural pathways that are in the way that don't allow Black people and other people of color the same access, the same opportunity to this elusive American social contract that we were never accounted for. So the other thing that I would also say is that whether Biden or Democrats win or lose on, you know, tomorrow, we need to find the courage in ourselves to also be a part of this conversation. We cannot expect our elected leaders to be the only people that are doing this for us. And we have to be able to have honest conversations about what that is in terms of who we have been and what we need to become to get there. And that means that sometimes we need to have conversations with our loved ones, with our neighbors, and with our foes. And that also is part of the dialogue that we need to get ourselves back to as a country. We got to be able to talk through difference, not just because it feels good, but because we live in a multiracial country. And we need to look at the fact that this is an intergenerational challenge, and we need an intergenerational leadership. So we also need Democrats that have been in power for a long time to look at which ways they can step out of the way and let the next generation of leaders like Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley or Congresswoman Cori Bush or Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez to take on a bigger leadership role in the next Congress if possible. Wherever we can make headways, let's actually demonstrate as Democrats, whether it's in D.C. or right here locally in Massachusetts, what does it mean for Democrats to get out of the way and actually allow for a new coalition of leaders to emerge with the understanding that no one's asking you to leave the room, nor should you, but that we need all of us to be in this room, but that you can't expect some of us to continue to be in the back, just holding and waiting for our time to come up.
Let's go to the phones, 800-423-8255. I'd like to take a couple calls here. We've got Eldon on the line from Jamaica Plain. Eldon, go ahead.
Hi, yes. I just want to applaud WBR for both the juxtaposition of having both David Gergen, who I admire and I've read, you know, and caught up in everything that he has written and follow him, and then have been a big fan of Wimmelia, especially for the last few years since I returned back to my hometown of Boston. I've been in New York and back and in politics and doing political organizing and some consulting. And I have to tell you that I think this is a great moment for more people like this next generation, especially like Wimmelia, who has taken up a new form of kind of thinking. And what I'm excited about, albeit in the midst of a pandemic, and a lot of this...
Eldon, I need you to get to the end of it. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm sorry. So what I'm excited about is that there's a moment right now where we are going to, yes, some people will say a possible change in the way we're looking at politics, but I think it's what we're in a moment where we can actually look at a rebirth of this nation by looking at the way we include all of our voices.
Great.
And I think it's exciting about people, you know, all
Thank
of
you,
us
Eldon.
To really have an input. And I think it does start in the way we deal with party politics and the Democratic Party.
So, Eldon, I'm going to take it back from you there because I do want to have room to get Kevin in. He's from a car on route something, but I can't see it on my screen. But, Kevin, quickly, you're up.
Thank you. I have a question for Mr. Gergen. Mr. Gergen, what happens if President Trump refuses to concede?
Okay, let's turn to you, David Gergen. If you could do that in a minute or so, that'd be great.
Just two quick points. I hope that tomorrow will represent not a continuation of a darkening environment, but a celebration of democracy. If all this effort and all this avalanche of people who've gone to the polls, all these young people have been involved, that would be really, I think, foundation for rejoicing. And I also agree with the notion that it's time for the older generation to start opening up spots for the newer generation. I think it's really, really important as we go forward here. On the question of what happens if the president refuses to concede, nobody knows. It's a very, very tough one. I think if it's a big victory for Biden, that this issue will dissipate very quickly. But if it's a very small margin for Biden, then we're going to have a lot of conflicts and court cases and one thing and another. Ultimately, the Constitution is quite clear. On January 20th, the person who has lost the election is done. It's over. That person has lost power. But what do we do if that's Trump and he refuses to go? I hope it doesn't mean, you know, calling in the National Guard, calling in the military to evict him. I can't imagine we're going to get to that stage. But right now, I think there is very strong reason to worry about how we're going to get through the next 2 or 3 days.
Mm-hmm. Well, Nelia, last 30 seconds or so to you, just sort of parting thought. What are you watching for this week?
You know, parting thought, just building off of what David just said, we need all Americans of all stripes of life to remain vigilant and engaged, no matter what that means for you, whether you have the capacity to vote tomorrow or have been able to or not, or made that choice for yourself. Stay engaged, not just for these next 2 or 3 days, because they will be critical, but for the next few weeks and the next few years. This is an intergenerational commitment, and we can't just look at this as another news cycle, because it's what got us here.
Well, I am going to fangirl alongside of Eldon and say it was so cool to have the two of you join us today. We've had Wimmelia Rivera, Democratic strategist and founder of Rivera Consulting, former chief strategist for Representative Ayanna Pressley's 2018 campaign, and David Gergen, advisor to 4 U.S. presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. Now he's at the Harvard Kennedy School. So cool. Thanks to you both.
Thanks.
It's an honor. Thank you.
What a treat. And that is our show for today. Radio Boston's a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston. NPR News Station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow on Election Day for more Radio Boston.